It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, new research on the plague, a.k.a. the Black Death, shows it might be more than a menace from the past. It could make an appearance in our future. We'll find out more with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
First, lawmakers and some veterans groups are calling for investigations into conditions and care at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. The facility has come under scrutiny since a Capital Times investigation found allegations of widespread neglect at the same time as the state transferred millions in surplus funding away from King.
Caitlin Farrell joins us now to talk about how veterans groups are responding to these allegations and how likely an investigation might be. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter for the Capital Times. Caitlin, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Caitlin, you joined us to talk about the story you broke, but briefly recap what you found, what you heard about at this veterans home at King.
Sure. So my story just talked about concerns from former employees there, current employees, residents and family members about quality of care issues and concerns about that, some medical errors in light of excess revenue and surpluses that the home was making and being transferred out of the home and back to the state agency in record numbers. So sort of seeing money leaving the facility as we're seeing care being compromised or not being at the highest level.
In some of your newest reporting on this, you've gotten responses from veterans groups here in Wisconsin responding to some of the issues you brought to light. What kind of things did you hear?
Right. So far we've heard from three veteran service organizations in the state. The American Legion, which is the largest one in the country, put out a release last week. And we've also heard from AMVETS and the Military Order of the Purple Heart. The American Legion, I took a pretty even-handed approach, I would say, and one of the highlights of their release talked about how one veteran complaint is one too many. They voiced support generally for reviews into the conditions of the home and how money was spent. AMVETS took a different approach and disputed much of what my reporting found and sort of thought that much of the criticism and much of the work that I had done was pretty politically motivated. So they were upset about that. And AMVETS, or the Military Order of the Purple Heart, took a similar tone and defended the practice of transferring excess revenue because this is a policy that has been endorsed by both the Doyle administration and the Walker administration. So it's not necessarily a new thing, but because the facility is making so much money, we're just seeing larger transfers than we had in the past.
Right, and the latter two groups that you mentioned disputed the idea that there was subpar care. They're saying they're hearing good things from people there. Is it the case that there might be some isolated instances that people were talking to you about, but in general, these groups are arguing anyway care is pretty good there?
Yeah, I mean, I think what the bulk of my reporting really sought to focus on was conditions of care for the most vulnerable veterans there that are really the sickest and the most elderly. And that was where a lot of the concerns that I heard from employees really came from. So I definitely agree that one's experience at King and their perception of the quality of care there, you know, it's going to be different. And my story quoted several people and volunteers who talked about the good work that volunteers and staff try to do there, and that there, you know, there's good things that happen there too. There's a lot of amenities that are offered, but you know, like I said, many of the people that I talked to still felt there was still widespread agreement over concern for some of the sickest and most elderly veterans that had problems that they felt, you know, maybe couldn't adequately be addressed.
Talking to Caitlin Farrell, reporter for the Capital Times, about the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. She broke a story last week talking to a lot of people, as she said, family members, residents, staff, volunteers at that center. Caitlin, we've talked about reaction from veterans service organizations in Wisconsin. State lawmakers have been talking about this since your report came out. What kind of things are we hearing?
Right. So the state lawmakers have been talking about this. They have decided the lawmakers who are on the Joint Legislative Audit Committee have scheduled a meeting. They plan to vote to authorize an audit, and they have a meeting scheduled for September 21st, and it will also be broadcast live online as well, so folks can listen in. But I'm told by the co-chairs of that committee that they will likely vote to authorize an audit, a pretty hefty 6 to 9 month look into the facility that will look at some of the concerns about care, the shortages in staffing, and looking at, you know, why the facility is able to bring in so much excess revenue and where that, you know, where that surplus is going and how it's being spent.
Are you getting the sense from lawmakers that they're reacting angrily to the news audit here, or they're more in a sense of, okay, let's do this audit, see what's happening, and then decide if we should be outraged by what's going on?
It's been a mixed bag, really. I mean, I think I've heard the most partisan, if you will, outrage from Democratic lawmakers. You know, Senator Luther Olson has been, you know, that's his district. He's been, you know, the most vocal Republican voice. Outrage. I mean, I think he has definitely been, you know, disappointed and expressed, you know, grave concern. I think other lawmakers haven't been as vocal or public with the outrage, but really everyone is on board, it seems, with having the audit go forward and sort of see what that reveals.
And you mentioned that the audit would include not just the care, but the use of money that's coming from the federal government to King and then being allocated elsewhere for veterans' work here in Wisconsin. Where is that money going? What kind of things is it being used for?
Right. So that in during the Walker administration, that money has been transferred into what's called the Veterans Trust Fund, which is a pot of money that is managed by the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. And they spend that money on a variety of other programs and benefits for veterans. So they have their own education grant, and they have a grant program for low income veterans. But they also do pay administrative salaries from that same pot of money as well. They've helped fund a museum in Madison, and also they do cemetery upkeep as well. So that fund has had some structural deficits, some issues over the last few years, and so this excess revenue from these homes really is the only sustaining revenue that this fund has. So, you know, it's sort of a question, I think, in many people's minds, whether this should be a policy the state has, whether, you know, if the revenue that's being brought into the state for very sick veterans, if it's fine that it's spent ostensibly on other veterans for other things that they need. But that's where the money's going. It's going into the Veterans Trust Fund.
And Caitlin, that committee's meeting to decide, you mentioned, on a state-level audit of this. I believe some Democrats have been hoping for a federal audit of the facility at King. Is there any talk of that still?
Right. They've sent a letter. So state Democrats have sent a letter to the federal Department of Veterans Affairs, the secretary. I have not heard any response on that front. Also, Senator Tammy Baldwin has endorsed that as well. And Russ Feingold, who's, you know, running to reclaim his seat in the Senate from Senator Ron Johnson, has also endorsed that. And so I have not heard. I am unaware of a response that they've gotten from the federal VA, but they've sent that letter, and some of our representatives on the federal side. Also, Congressman Ron Kind has also said that he wants a federal investigation. So,
Caitlin, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Yep, thank you.
That's Caitlin Farrell, public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times. She joined us for an update on allegations of neglect at the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King. You may think of the plague, if you think of the plague, known scientifically as Yersinia pestis, as a thing of the past. But recent research on the genome of the disease says it could be part of our future, too.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to share the details of this and other top news stories in the world of science. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, and she joins us once a month. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, and a very happy, hopefully plague-free Monday to you.
And it's a little scary what Rob just said, that the plague could be part of our future, but it seems as though there have been these lingering questions around the plague and what we know about it, so we haven't been really able to put it to rest. What are we learning now?
Well, you know, the really fascinating thing is if you say the plague or the Black Death, everyone knows what you're talking about, right? We immediately think of the medieval period and a little bit later, a 300-year period in our history when there was a very good chance that you or someone you knew was going to die of plague. But, you know, for all we know about it, we didn't really know what it was, where it came from. We couldn't really understand it on a genetic basis. And it's really been in the past few years that they have been able to actually isolate a sample from London, from a late Middle Ages cemetery, plague cemetery, and actually sequence the genome and understand what the plague was then and confirm that it is still with us. It's the same scourge that's been with us for centuries. And, it can make a big comeback.
Well, yeah, and before we get to that comeback, this was an open debate. We had this disease that exists in the present day, not as widespread, thankfully, and there was an argument. Some people didn't believe that it was the same disease that killed, what, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people in Europe and elsewhere, and now we've locked this down.
Yeah, and it's been in the past few years that we have the genetic evidence that proves from this, you know, plague cemetery victim, that proves the plague that decimated populations hundreds of years ago is the same organism that is with us today. And, you know, just in 2015, 16 people in the United States were infected with plague, and four of them died. So even though we don't hear about it that often, it's still with us. It's still kind of there right under the radar.
And not always under the radar, right? I mean, the story in Discover opens with a mountain lion that dies, and it's not what it seems like. It's modern plague, right?
Yeah, exactly. And unfortunately, the wildlife biologist who was studying the animal to figure what killed it contracted the plague and died from it. So these are, you know, they might not be making headlines all the time, but there are these cases kind of bubbling under the radar all the time.
Now, we're a different place with different hygiene, different medical system than medieval Europe, I think mostly for the better. is there a thought that, I mean, plague could somehow evolve, change to be a threat again in the modern day?
Yeah, and you know, one of the really interesting aspects of the new research is that they're going back and they're looking at these trees in Central Asia that have been around for 1,000 years, the same trees. They live a really long time. And they're able to look at the tree rings and determine what climate was like. And the researchers linked those climate indicators to outbreaks of the plague. So they were able to figure out that there's actually a cyclical climate pattern that can promote the perfect conditions for plague. And with climate change becoming more and more of a reality every day, I mean, you just have to look at the weather stories out there to see it in action. Basically, we are kind of setting the world up for some great opportunities for plague to get a foothold. It has to do with global transit. It has to do with conditions that cause the rodent population, where plague likes to hang out the most. It causes those rodent populations to collapse, and then the fleas that carry the plague have to look for, you know, a new place to live. They have to get a new apartment, so they hop on the nearest camel or horse or human.
So are there any cautionary lessons to be learned from some of this research yet, or is it still too early?
It's still a work in progress. And, you know, we have made advances in terms of how we treat plague, how we can diagnose it, et cetera. So the chances for a Black Death-size outbreak are not what they were in the year 1348, believe me. But that said, it's still a threat, and it's still something we have to plan for. The good news is science has really upped its game in the plague department, and we have a much better understanding of it now.
Stupid question to end with, Gemma.
I love stupid questions.
Yeah, plague, bacteria that antibiotics might work on, or virus that they won't?
Oh, yeah. No. It's a plague. It's a plague. Yes, it's a plague. But it's a bacteria, and antibiotics are effective against it until it develops resistance.
And just as part of this, I want to bring out that struck me. Apparently, these microorganisms, some of them that were used to sequence DNA, are found in the pulp of teeth. Is that scientists got this material from?
Exactly. That plague victim that I mentioned that was found in what we knew was a plague cemetery, in other words, a mass burial ground where they only put victims of the plague, it was from the tooth that they were able to extract this information.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine about some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. Let's do a 180, Gemma, from a thing that killed lots and lots of humans to research into why humans are living longer, some people in some places living past 100. So genetics, what are we looking at when it comes to the genetics of people who live to 100?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different things, and this is another area where science is uncovering all of these new aspects of even looking at the process of aging. And, you know, you can reduce the stress in your life, you can eat healthily, you can get exercise, have a really positive support network of friends and family, but the truth is the biggest factor to making it to 100 with a good quality of life, you got to win the genetic lottery. And there are a lot of different aspects that we see. Part of it is you may have protective genes that help you ward off pathogens. The flip side of it is you may have genes that predispose you towards getting a disease, and that makes it harder to reach the magical 100 number. And also, there's this thing called methylation. And I know we've talked about it a little bit before or previously, but basically, it's in the field of epigenetics, they look at the ways environmental factors can really actually turn genes on and off, change how your DNA expresses itself, and that can also open you up to a lot of different diseases. So there's a ton of different things, and just even within the genes, they're finding that genes age at different rates within the cells, and this is just really kind of on the vanguard, and it's fascinating research, but you got to win the genetic lottery to see 100.
Well, and it sounds like part of this is that we may have kind of an aging clock within us, and someone else's clock might be kind of slow and they're lucky. Mine might be faster and I'm less lucky. So how do we tease all of that out?
Yeah, exactly. And that has to do really with telomeres. They're basically the caps on the ends of the chromosomes, and they wear away. Each time the cell divides, they wear a little bit away. Now, some people have longer telomeres and they wear away more slowly. Other people, well, you know, they kind of got the short end of the stick genetically, so to speak, and their telomeres wear away faster. And as soon as the telomere is worn away, that cell basically dies, and it does not replicate. And it's just that's one of the reasons there are a lot of diseases in old age that are very specific to your cells dying. And they are just trying to figure out, they're just starting to figure out why the telomeres are different lengths, why they wear away, what causes them to wear away faster or slower. They're just getting to the bottom of it. So maybe in a couple of years we can have this conversation again and I have some concrete goodies to report. But right now it's just really at the dawn of this. It's in its infancy.
Right. Is the thought, though, that by doing this research, understanding the ways people age differently, the way these clocks work differently, that there will be some kind of potential for applied science down the road so that if we want this to happen, more people live to 100?
Yeah, you know, that's always the hope. It's always the hope. I mean, that's why they're doing this research, to really understand it and then figure out how to manipulate these natural processes. But, you know, it's so early that you just don't want to say, yes, this is going to help us all live to 120 and we'll all still be driving our cars and leaving the left blinker on as we do. But, you know, it's too early to say.
And before we switch topics for our last story, I got to ask you about blue zones because, well, basically I want to move there. It sounds like this is the place to be if you want to live past 100. What are these blue zones and why do people live so long there?
Yeah, you know, there are these five different zones in Japan, Greece, Italy, and Costa Rica. There's also one in Loma Linda, California. It's the only U.S. site. And people just have an excellent chance of living to 100 or beyond. There are a lot of different factors. Some of these zones, it has to do with people, you know, a lot of people from the same family or same extended relations living there, so they have their genetic lottery all in one spot. But it has to do also with some lifestyle changes. They tend to have a leisurely pace of life and eat a plant-based diet. And again, they have that really positive support network of friends and family. So it's a lot of different factors, but really it's the genes really underlying their chances of seeing, 100 candles on their next birthday cake.
And Gemma, finally, I want to go out into space now. Not literally. I think there'd be a lot of motion sickness there. But out in a mysterious neighborhood on the edge of our solar system, scientists may be discovering another planet?
Yeah, the mysterious Planet Nine. You know, we are always, it's kind of embarrassing. We know so much about space, and yet we know so little. We're always finding stuff in our own solar system. Planet Nine has been theorized for a long time. It is a massive planet. Think, they're saying it's, you know, 10 times the mass of Earth. So it's a big, big planet, and it's way, way out there, way, way beyond Pluto and the Kuiper Belt, which is that zone around Pluto that has all kinds of goodies in it. And basically, it could be on a 5 to 100 billion mile away from the sun orbit. That's, we're talking potentially 100 billion miles away from the sun. It has this huge orbit, and we don't know that it's there by observing the light that it gives us, because we haven't seen it. We only know it's there because of its gravity. And, you know, as it swings around in this enormous orbit, it kind of pushes everything else out of the way. And because we're seeing stuff get pushed out of the way, that's how researchers think that this huge thing is out there. And they're hoping, they're embarking on a new phase of research, looking for it to confirm it. And hopefully we'll hear something in the next couple of years, for sure.
Oh, really? So a couple of years. So what are they, it says we can't see this thing, and we're relying on the math to show that gravitation is pushing stuff out of the way. What do they need to do to actually prove that it's there?
How much time do you have?
In 10 seconds or less.
Okay. Basically, they're going to use a new telescope to really dig in there and see if we can identify, either for sure by its gravitational pull, what it's doing out there, or maybe even see that faint, faint light.
You actually had a little more than 10 seconds.
You did well, though.
Yeah, that was great.
Oh, you played me, man.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's the next step? We're actually trying to do this? We've got this telescope fired up?
Well, I mean, the telescope is existing, but, you know, researchers, they can't just, like, show up one day at the telescope and say, hey, let me hop on this thing for a couple minutes. They have to apply for time. And we're right now in the position where Mike Brown, the researcher from Caltech, is in the process of saying, please, 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 please let me have some time on this telescope. As you can imagine, a lot of astronomers want a piece of that telescope. So we're not sure he's going to be able to do it, but I think he's made a fantastic case for being able to do it.
Gemma, thanks so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to talk about some of the most exciting news from the world of science and technology. It's about 2,000 miles from Berkeley, California to the Bayou Country of Louisiana. But the geographic distance is nothing compared to the political distance between the liberal California college town and the red state politics of a Tea Party stronghold.
Our next guest spent years working to bridge that gap. As a sociologist from Berkeley, she wanted to get beyond the easy stereotypes and understand what drives people from a low-income and working-class community to embrace conservative politics. She says her findings give insight to the rise of Donald Trump and maybe toward finding political common ground.
Arlie Russell Hochschild joins us now. She's Professor Emerita of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. Her latest book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Arlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, what made you want to get this up-close look at people in Louisiana on the right side of American politics?
I wanted to dive into the red state paradox. How could it be that the poorest states, the states with the worst education, the worst health, the lowest life expectancy, were the ones that received the most federal money, but were more suspicious and negative about the federal government? That's kind of the whole red state paradox. And I wanted to go to the center of that, and that's actually Louisiana, which this year is now the poorest state, and it's 44% of its state budget comes from the federal government, and it's Trump country. They're going to be Trump won the primary, and it's heavily Tea Party. So it seemed like an exaggeration of this thing I didn't understand, you know? And so I spent 5 years actually getting to know some extraordinary people. It's been the funnest research I've ever done. And I've tried to cross an empathy bridge into the experience of people that I'm very pleased to have met, but with whom I have great political differences.
And you write that I think a lot of times it's easy to stereotype people from the other side of the political fence, whichever side you're on. You wanted to get into what you call the deep story of how people look at politics. Can you talk about what that means?
Yes. I hung out with people. I asked them where they were born and where they could we go to their school. You know, where did they sit at what desk in the school schoolroom? Where were their parents buried? You know, where their kids going to school? Just kind of really get into things, and I did things with them and went fishing and to gumbo cook-offs and fish fries. And through all that listening, and I listened with my own alarm system off. You know how you do. You just kind of really, hey, the purpose of this is to get what the other person's really feeling. And what it came down to was this deep story. It's, if you were to tell it as a metaphor, it would be like this. You're waiting in line, as in a pilgrimage, sort of leading up to a point at the top of the hill where you can find the American dream. And you feel very deserving. You have worked your butt off. And you're waiting in line for this American dream. And you notice suddenly that somebody's butting in front. Who is that? Well, it's an affirmative action black, or it's an affirmative who's getting access to jobs previously denied to blacks, or a woman, a career-minded woman who affirmative action is trying to get access to a job that was formerly reserved for men, and then migrants and immigrants and refugees. All these people seem to be getting ahead of you in line. The line is now moving backwards. And then you see someone to the side of it. That would be Barack Obama, who seems to be waving to the people cutting in line in cahoots with him. And then you feel like, hey, the government isn't helping me. It's helping them. And in fact, is the government a whole marginalization machine? You know, shouldn't we just reduce that if that's what it is? And then finally you see somebody ahead of you in line who's turning around saying, oh, you white cracker, you redneck, you're uneducated, ignorant, Southern. And you feel insulted for all the pain of first trying to get moved forward in line and then being pushed back. That is the deep story. I went back to my people with it, and they said, yeah, that's it. Or then they changed it and said, yeah, and we're paying taxes to the people who are cutting in line. Or then we got out of line, started our own line. They would modify the story. But I think all of us, actually, underneath the talk of policies and values, have a deep story. I mean, progressives have theirs, and right-wingers have theirs. And what we have to do is really grok what that feels like. A deep story, I should say, has judgments taken out and facts taken out. It's just how reality feels. And if we can sensitize ourselves to the deep story of the people across the way, I think then we can open out conversations about crossover issues and begin to heal this divide.
We're talking to Arlie Russell Hochschild. She is the author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, looking at the political divide in this country. She came from blue state Berkeley, California, to red state Bayou, Louisiana. And Arlie, it seems really easy to not hear that deep story. And when you hear people on the left talking about people on the right and vice versa, they are saying things that make perfect sense to themselves and either no sense or alienating to the people on the other side. Is that where our political discourse mostly is these days?
I think so. And it's really time to turn it around and correct our pictures of the other side. I think we're all inside a giant paradox. If you look at the public square, there's enormous acrimony and hostility. But then you go home and you talk to your best friend and the person next door, and there's perfect harmony and agreement. You know, so publicly, people are at each other's throats. Privately, we live in enclaves, geographic enclaves, electronic enclaves, media enclaves. You know, some people are watching Fox News. Other people are watching MSNBC. And so we've got to get out of our enclaves, make that act, make that commitment to do that. Mind open, alarm system off, and really get to know people on the other side.
I want to play... I want to play an example of this in action. Hillary Clinton, this came out in the news this weekend, talking about Donald Trump supporters. I'm going to play a clip. This actually has two bits of this speech. Here it is.
Be grossly generalistic. You can put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. But that other basket of people are people who feel the government has let them down, the economy has let them down, nobody cares about them.
So, I mean, different people have reacted to this differently. Liberal, progressive supporters of Hillary Clinton is saying, hey, she's arguing against the idea that all Donald Trump supporters are racist, xenophobic, etc. The other half of the country, I think, is hearing this, but you just called a big portion of Donald Trump supporters racist, xenophobic, etc.
I know. It's a real mistake. And to her credit, she quickly walked it back. But... I'd like to invite her to Lake Charles, Louisiana, to Longville, to DeRidder, to Bayou Corn Sinkhole, as it's now called, where she would find Trump supporters. But they are people with very complex objections to things he does, but who fit her second description, that is, of people who don't feel heard, who feel marginalized demographically, culturally, economically, and even in age, because these are older whites. And it adds up to a kind of a tipping point after which they feel like strangers in their own land and looking for a way to get out of that state, which they are in mourning about, I believe.
We're talking to sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild. Her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. She's sharing her story of her work as a sociologist from one of the most liberal parts of the United States, getting to know people in one of the most conservative areas.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you're a conservative, do you think you're unfairly stereotyped by liberals? And if you're a liberal, same question about conservative views of you and your politics. Are you able to find common ground with people on different sides of the partisan divide? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to Arlie Russell Hochschild. She is a sociologist, and her latest book is called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And she's sharing her experience as a blue state sociologist talking to Tea Party supporters in red state America.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think we're too quick to stereotype people on the other side of the political spectrum? Have you been able to maintain, even build friendships with people who have different political values than your own? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Arlie, before we get to our callers, let's talk about the people in Louisiana you worked with and the rise of Donald Trump. A lot of people, especially on the left, are heavily fact-checking Donald Trump, trying to point out misstatements of fact. In a way, it seems like that doesn't matter. He's speaking to feelings, not facts. With people.
I think that's right. That's why we have to go to feelings and back up and look at what experience has led them to be. That's I think, the first order of business. Then we can it set down a pathway, an emotional pathway of mutual respect, and look at the crossover issues, which I think there are a lot of things that we would agree on. There, and I should say that a lot of the members of the Tea Party had a lot of reservations about Trump, too. I mean, he's going to bring on big government if he's going to add 90,000 troops. We're going to have to pay for that. They were very concerned about the debt. Likely the debt will go up. So they didn't like that part of it at all. And others were offended that, you know, he seemed to be ridiculing the disabled and blacks, and they didn't like that. So what this means is that, not that they love all of Donald Trump, but that they don't feel spoken to by anybody else.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got John on the line in Grand Rapids. John, hi.
Yeah, it's just hard for me to believe that a lot of this isn't related to race. When the economy turned bad, people turned on each other. And I've experienced this personally as a public employee. And I've heard a lot of negative comments about my choices and my occupation and how I'm overpaid, et cetera. And I think there's a lot of people, when the economy went sour, turned on people.
John, thanks for the call. So there is resentment. Some of it may be fair, but some of it maybe not, Arlie.
Oh, a lot of it is not. An excellent point, John. Actually, at the end of my book, I have an appendix, which is kind of a fact checker, and it looks at wages and benefits of public and private employees, and finds that public employees, given the level of education that they have and experience, are not more highly paid than private. So, see, at the end of this, if we set down the pathway and really get to a moment of mutual respect, we can begin to look at the facts in a dispassionate way and see that they're wrong to be prejudiced against you.
John, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to John in Beloit. John, hi.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me. I think she's a little bit off. I think that more or less, I think America's middle in general, I think, holds actually slightly to the right. I think that in America, I think most of us, I'm a Republican, a union member also, so I mean, I kind of fall on both sides of the line. But I think we're more disgruntled about the Congress, the Senate, and the president. It has, I mean, everybody can blame Barack Obama as the president. Okay, I'll give you that. But I think a lot of it over the last 30 years, corporations have had all of the access and gotten all of the rulings. And basically, everybody says, well, the great almighty dollar. Well, if you really looked at things, the Congress and everybody has always turned and looked at the profitability and marginability. And then you had the great issues in 2008 where everything fell down. And yet, what do? They bailed everybody at the top out, but they didn't bail out anybody at the bottom. I mean, if in America, think about this. The best thing Americans could do would everybody go file bankruptcy, just like the big banks did. And then guess what? We don't have to worry about our debt just like they didn't, and things like that. And so you hear that hostility, I'm sure, in my voice, but it's real. Because they keep giving to all these people because they have big dollars to contribute to campaigns.
John, I want to cut in and give our guest a chance to respond. Thank you very much for calling. I mean, what John is saying, Congress, the president, too cozy with big, powerful elite interests, bail them out first. You could hear that from a Tea Party member, I think, from Donald Trump, from Bernie Sanders, from Hillary Clinton, and you could hear it from
Bernie Sanders.
And yes. From Occupy Wall Street, for that matter.
That's right. Hi, John, number two. You have more than you might think in common with progressives who would agree with everything you have said, and who so think about that. You sound like Bernie Sanders, and so did a lot of the Tea Party people that I talked to. They would agree with you also. And one man, I was out fishing with him, big Tea Party person who will vote Trump, kind of said, you know, we need to get money out of politics. And I thought, wow, that is a major crossover issue. Let's do it.
John, thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to Arlie Russell Hochschild. Her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Back to our callers now with Dan and Oshkosh. Dan, hi.
Hi, yeah, great topic, great guest. And I'm a liberal, but I monitor the right-wing media, the alt-right media. And, boy, I tell you, I get tired and actually get shocked by the way that they define who liberals and progressives are, because many times they couldn't be further from the truth. But in order to perpetuate their little radio programs, they use indifference, intolerance, anger, and hatred, and that's the wedge that they keep driving between left and right, progressive, liberal, Democrat, Republican, and all just to, you know, because they're doing corporate media to perpetuate their little radio programs. And I just hope people will pay closer attention as to where they are getting their information.
Dan, thanks for the call. So Dan pointing the finger at conservative media, online, radio, and so forth, Arlie, in creating wedge issues that make our partisan divide bigger.
Right, and that do run their programs. That's why I think we need people-to-people democracy. We need to get out of our enclaves and make a real effort to encounter personally people that have different beliefs. If each of us did it just once, you know, and really had a friendship, really made a relationship, but everyone on both sides did it, I think we could heal this divide and do an end run around the Rush Limbaughs and other right-wing commentators.
Dan, thanks for the call. Time for one more call from Jake in Milwaukee. Jake, hi.
Yeah, I'm a progressive, and to be honest, I don't want to find any common ground with the racists and sexists and homophobes. You know, chance of those people getting in power in this state, they try to marginalize Democratic voters, become autocrats, and I just don't want to. Those people are the past in this country, and it's still their country too, but they don't want other people to have power or have what they've had.
Jake, thanks for the call. Arlie, what would you say to somebody like Jake?
Jake, I appreciate your comments, but I have to disagree. I think we can't afford the luxury of standing apart from one another. And especially if you're a progressive, you have to have noticed that progressives are losing ground, and we're very close to this is a very close election, and the very people that you don't want to get to know are driving this. I think the shoe is on the progressive foot to see that while Democrats claim to put forward the interests of blue-collar America, blue-collar America is turning right, and we can't afford to turn our back on that. And these aren't all evil racists either.
Arlie, very briefly, I mean, do you think there's a forum? Do we have a public square where people can come together from both sides just in 15 seconds or so?
Yes, there is. It's called Living Room Conversations. And there's a person named Joan Blades, who is a co-founder of MoveOn.org and Moms Rising. And she's getting left and right together in living rooms. And you can Google it, and that's a good place to start.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Arlie Russell Hochschild. Her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. We pay a lot of attention to talking here on this talk radio show, and there's two big trends, right, Veronica, in the way people talk and talk about how millennials talk.
Well,
and we were talking about this earlier.
And everybody, to a certain extent, has some of these things, men and women alike. So we have vocal fry. Rob, would you like to demonstrate?
I have a hard time doing it on purpose, but vocal fry. Like when your voice kind of goes, you do it better.
I don't think that was quite.
No, not quite.
I would say vocal fry.
Fry. I could do it accidentally. I have a hard time doing it on purpose. All right.
And the other one is uptalk.
Uptalk.
Just turning things into a question, which are actually statements.
Turning things into a question, which are actually statements.
There you,
like that.
There
I did
you
a little youth line. So what I was wondering earlier today, because we're students, right, of spoken language, can you do vocal fry and uptalk at the same time?
So essentially today you invented upfry.
Upfry. And it's horrible. And we'll each do it. We'll each try it once. It doesn't sound good.
The sky is blue.
Right. And can I uptalk on vocal fry? Which, so basically vocal fry uptalk. What did you call it?
Upfry.
Upfry. You have to sound like a chicken.
Right.
So I don't know. I'm hoping that this is a fad we have not just invented.
Yeah, it's pretty much
it's
the worst, most annoying vocal mannerism ever. Don't try it at home.
Do not.
We hope you don't replicate it.
Yeah, and we'll stop trying to do it around the office, though it's hard to break once you get started. This is Central Time.
On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.